Good evening, everyone. Happy quarantine. All right. Welcome, everyone, to this week's episode of Get the Fork Out. This week, we have a friend of mine, a fellow motorcycle rider, Dirk Montje, and he is the owner of Superyacht Galley Interiors. He is from Holland, and right now he's in the MKM Demo Center in Belfeld, Holland, which I think I got the name right, but it's somewhere in the center of Holland. Dirk, welcome to Get the Fork Out.
Thank you, Brandon. Thank you for having me, for inviting
me. Of course.
Welcome.
Of course. Thanks. Why don't you explain to people exactly what you've been doing and for how long, and tell us all about your business.
Okay, that's a long story. I started in 2003 in 1996 as a service technician in catering equipment. My parents-in-law, they had a hotel, and I was a plumber, junior plumber, and I seen all the guys coming in do the service on the equipment in the restaurant kitchen, and I thought, oh, that's something for me. So I started when I was 18 years old as a service technician. In 2003, I started my own company, and what we did where I worked was only installation, and we never did any service. So little service.
Okay.
When I started my own company, I thought I need to do service. So service is the base, and all besides, we will see. We started there to do service on restaurants with like hotels for 300, 400 people, and with bigger kitchens.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's where our base is. I had like 20 employees, almost 20 employees, which I've sold 5 years ago.
Okay.
A little step back, 10 years before I sold the company, we started yachting, some specializing in galley yachting.
Okay.
When I sold my company, I said, okay, I only want to do galley yachting, service and refits worldwide with a small team of specialists. That's what we do now.
So, excellent.
Specialized in a galley service and galley refit.
Well, I think and your reputation is very good in the industry, by the way. Whenever like a refit gets mentioned, then it's always you and maybe one other person, like the name, I think two other people maybe, but your name usually comes up first, because I think you've made an effort to be part of the community and keep in touch with chefs and always say friendly things. You know, like I think I was riding through the Netherlands and you invited me to come for a motorcycle ride, or I was doing something up there, but I was so tight for time, I couldn't do it. I was visiting FedShip. Yeah. Okay. So that's kind of the main reason why I thought it'd be great to have you on this podcast, but like, I think for the purpose of benefiting like the chef community, maybe you could walk us through just advice for chefs that maybe they're newer to the industry and they've never had the opportunity to do a refit. And so of course they want it, you know, like, of course they want new equipment. They want to get rid of the shit that's not working. It's old. And so what would be some of the advice for kind of a newer chef in the industry with their first refit?
Well, what do you do? In the first time when we meet the chef, or when we come on board, we normally get invited by like a sales representative of a shipyard or a sales representative of a owner, owner's rep.
Yeah.
And when we come on board, we talk with the chef and we talk with like the captain. What's the style of the boat? What do you cook for like a big group? Do you do a lot of outside work outside the boat in the beach or something like that?
Yeah.
How many crew do you have on board? It's also very very important.
Definitely.
And then we make it like a plan. So what do you want to have in your galley? Well, all the chefs, they want to have everything. Everything what's for sale.
All the toys.
And what they love is like, I want to put something in, and then next week we have another project. Oh, we put it out and we do something else, like a fryer. Oh, no, next week we don't need a fryer, but we need a fry top. And then that's what they want.
Yeah,
that's impossible. We know that, all of us know it. So we make a plan together. We're going to sit and we make like a rough sketch and what do you need for how many people, blah, blah, blah. When it is finished, I go most of the time to a chief engineer or back to the yard, to the shipyard. What do they have for electricity connection? Is it like 400 volt European power? Is it American power? All the things like that.
Okay.
With that in mind, we make a plan, like a rough sketch. And then we go back to the chef, to the art chef. Okay, you want to have like 10 pieces of equipment, but we only have space and power for 5. So what are you going to do? We're going to use this and that and that and that and that. Something you know also.
Trim down the list, yeah, for sure.
And then I'm going to sit with the chef. Okay, what are you going to do? I think I have a little bit experience from the last 25 years. And then we try to make something what solves for everybody. So for the engineers, for the power supply, for the power consumption, for the chef, maybe chef.
That's something I want to say too. And correct me if I'm wrong, but basically all the newer equipment uses a lot more power. So if you have an older boat, usually the wiring harness, like I think that's more of a motorcycle term, that comes out of the engine room is only going to supply a certain amount of power. So is that true? Like with an older boat, you can't have probably all the newer things that you want, and you've got to just get the kilowatts down.
Yeah. A lot of old boats, they have like the old convention electric hot plates. In the newer boats, we go over to induction. Induction is the new standard, what we use for cooking hubs. And a induction hub is like 14 kilowatts directly. Yeah. When you have like an old hot plate, you have like maybe 5 or 10. So that's sometimes a problem.
Yeah.
Most of the time when we come aboard, we are in a big refit. So then there's space with the electrical company of the shipyard to upgrade the power net, to upgrade the switchboard or the cables. And sometimes it isn't. And then we have to choose for our smaller equipment with smaller power consumption or for other equipment or less than it's asked for. That's sometimes really a problem. That's correct.
Okay. All right. Well, I just want to get that out there because I think a lot of the chefs, they won't realize you're going to be limited. Even if there's big, and some of these refits, like money is not really an issue. If the galley has been neglected for 10 years and things get needed, but oftentimes you're limited by the power that's already been supplied from, originally.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. I just want to double check. That was a fact. That's what I thought.
That is really a fact. And that's also something you see that not always happening, that the chef doesn't talk with the chief engineer or with the engineers of the boat. And they want to have like, a 100, but there's only space for 50. And that's what you said.
Well, like in my experience too, it's always a good collaboration. So I've done a refit on a 86 meter Fetchit XC and 74 meter Namaskrug. And now, like a little one on Arians, but like in my experience, it's a collaboration between like the whoever you're using for refit, the chef, the captain, the chief engineer, like, and even maybe the first officer. Like, somebody is going to say something where like, holy shit, that's a really good idea. I never would have thought of that. Like, and I think it's fun that way too for me. So when you say like some chefs don't talk to the chief engineer, I'm like, wow, maybe that's not the smartest chef in the world, but come on, you got to talk.
We always are a little bit in between the chef and the chief engineer, right? Because we are also engineers. I'm an engineer myself.
Yeah.
I always forgot my tie when I come on board for a new galley. I say, I forgot my tie. And then I come
in my
working clothes. And so you have like the click with the chef and also the click with the engineer, because you are an engineer. The other thing is that I'm doing this for quite a long years. So I know also a little bit about kitchens, not especially yacht kitchens. I think yachting we do now for 12, 13 years.
Yeah.
But also normal kitchen, big kitchens. And what you see a lot in the new builds, we normally don't do new builds, but what you see a lot in the new builds, that a galley is designed by an engineer of a shipyard or a designer, and they put all kinds of equipment in because that's always in. And then, we come after a year or we come for a service and then we don't use that and we don't use that. And that's also not used. And so when we come on board for a refit, we talk as a chef and as a technician, to both, and then you get more solutions or better solutions than from a
design. Yeah. I beat that new build drum pretty hard about like, come on, I don't understand how these money's no objects. It's like they build these galleys where you're like, no one was consulted in this, not one person. Yeah. And I mean, I get it. Building a boat is complicated. It's expensive, but you need these consultants to come on because like the excuse is, right? Every chef is different, which we are. Thank fuck for that. That's a good thing. But every chef can build a better galley than a captain. Even the most craziest chef is going to build a better boat than a captain. But then here's the other. Don't hire the craziest chef to be a consultant. Hire someone with a reputation that's done it a few times. Yeah. Or it's just, I don't understand how these boats get built the way they do. And this leads me to a question that I want to ask you anyway. And maybe you can't answer it honestly, which is fine. But like, do you think there's planned obsolescence in these new builds? Like, okay, we're not going to build the best galley because we know there's going to be a refit in 2 or 3 years.
No, I don't think that is happening.
Okay. That's a rumor.
Yeah, I need to be honest that we are not involved in new builds. We did maybe 2 or 3 times in design for new builds, but it's not our thing. I don't think that is the thing in new build. I think that it is more that we have a standard plan of a galley, and that plan has to fit in that new build. And then maybe there are some wishes left or right, but the standard things we always use, like for inductions, a salamander, which never is used.
thank you. It's never used.
A semi-pro dishwasher is also a thing we always have out after a year, all things like that, but that's always in the galley, so we put that in. And if it is left or right or whatever, and I think there is the thing I told you, that a designer is not a chef and is not an engineer as well. And that's a thing we may be missing in new builds, yes.
Yeah, it's just an interesting thing that happens where I think it's like what you said. You didn't say it exactly like this, but it's like there's a list of equipment, there's a room, just throw it in there,
yeah,
and that's it. And it's going to work, but it doesn't. Oh. And sometimes that room, it gets smaller and smaller because of like day heads and other stuff and just intrude upon it. Pantries too, and laundries, they also get messed up on these new builds. But rather than talk about new builds, which you don't do, we can talk about refits.
Refits.
But, are you allowed to talk about maybe not the boat, name of the boats, but like what's some of the, like the biggest ones you've done, or and how many are stripped down like 100% down to like a box and build it back up?
A lot. Most of the, I think we did like 10, 15 like that. So completely stripped out from the base walls, because the base walls is something always stays in.
Yeah. And
from there, we make a complete new plan. The biggest one we did was approximately 100 meter, 96 meter.
Wow.
So but it was quite a big one.
Oh, yeah.
With 2 galleys as well.
Okay.
But also smaller ones. We do a lot of a little bit older boats, like 50, 55, 60, 65 meters.
Yeah.
And then most of them from scratch. So everything out and everything new in.
It makes the most sense that way. It's the nicest way to do it, I think.
Also the most efficient way, I think.
Yeah, because if you're going to redo all the equipment, you might as well redo the cabinets. I mean, the cabinets are like a fraction of the cost compared to the equipment. So it's like, yeah, no, I get it. And
what you see a lot when you do a refit like that is that they have like a sink 1 meter from the left, and the new sink has to be like 1 meter 50 from the left. I say something, for example.
Yeah.
And your cabinet, but under the sink, needs to be changed as well. So,
of course.
Yeah, then it's better to rip everything out and rebuild it.
I want to ask you a question, but it might be somewhat controversial. So you've seen basically from the inside out all the works of all the shipyards. I mean, do you have a favorite shipyard where you're just like, are there shipyards you're like, no, never again, it's a mess?
We have them also, for sure. We have favorite for shipyards. We do a lot of work in Holland in some famous shipyards.
Yeah,
we all know them, but we never knew. Talk about names.
Fine,
we have some shipyards in Holland, but we do a lot of work with it. That's really nice to work with. But we know each other. Yeah. They know from us what we're doing. We know from them. We have some in the south of Europe. which we do a lot of work for. Some are better, some are worse. The other thing is when we come over, we only use the space of the shipyard. We bring our own fan, our own tools, our own equipment, our own people. So we come in, we discuss what we're going to do and what kind of time frame, and then we do what we have to do.
Yeah.
And what we see when we come over, we are like simple. We are like technicians, and we come, we do a job. And if the job needs to be done after 4 or after 6 or after 8 in the night or whatever, then we do it. And yeah, when you see that in the first 2 or 3 days in the shipyard, then they see, okay, that's okay. And then you get all the help and all the things from that.
Yeah.
Another thing that also helps, when we come from Holland, we have in Holland the famous Dutch stroopwafels. You know them?
Oh, my God. They are fantastic. Like, if they're around, if I come back, like, on a Saturday night from the bars or something, and I come back and I know they're around, I'm just like, 3, you're going to go in my mouth immediately. They're so good, man.
Everywhere where we come in the world, we bring the stroopwafels. And then, yeah, like, the security. And last time we were in Barcelona at the marina, and you're not allowed to drive in. So, oh, wait a minute. So I went to the car, had a package of stroopwafels, and you park over there, and shoot.
Over there. All right. Now everyone knows how to get into the marina. All right. Dutch waivers. I know. Yeah. I'm sure there's some yards in the south where you just you pull everything out and it's chaos, you know, like I worked on some of them in the beginning of my career and probably won't ever again unless I do something drastically wrong.
Some are a little bit more difficult, and then you have to change your mind a little bit. And then, but also in the US, we did a lot of work in the US. And,
110.
Also, when you are over there, you discuss something with people, and then okay. And then sometimes yes is it's kind of yes.
I think I know what state you're talking about. I think there's certain states that aren't going to be very direct with you, but yes, I can. For sure.
We are Dutch, maybe too direct sometimes. So we say yes and no is no, and bam, bam, bam.
Yeah, no, I really, my time working with people from Northern Europe, well, I guess say Holland and Germany, and shipyards in both those countries, and just the straightforwardness. And also, and I think people don't think this, but I think it's true, is the openness to ideas. If I pitch an idea and it makes sense, and I feel like the reputation is different than that, but I've seen the opposite with the people that I've worked with, where if you say something and it makes sense, they're all right. Yeah, that's, and I don't think they're just saying yes to say yes. So I like that collaboration. Like I think I said that before, it's like for a refit and you're planning where to go and how to put things in, and to have that collaboration is massive. And if some chefs are too pigheaded and they don't want to listen or have a laugh with the engineer or the guy coming in to do the refit and just collaborate, you get a better galley.
You need to collaborate, because when you go into a refit, and especially when you go in like another country than your own country, and when we go like south of Europe or America or somewhere else, then you have always a short time frame. It's not as easy as when you're in Holland and we have like a refit from 1 year. You can start in the 10th of February and it needs to be finished in the 1st of May. Then you have, we have time enough, and we go to a workshop and make something else. And when you are somewhere else, which we are the most, then it's you need some collaboration and some good planning.
Well, that leads to my next question. I mean, if you want to do a refit, you'd rather just do it in your backyard. It's just easier, faster, more efficient. But like, What are some of the kind of the craziest places that you've had to do, you know, a sizable refit where it was legitimate tear down the galley? And then the next question is, do you have any like cool stories about trying to fit large pieces of equipment into small boat openings made of steel?
Yes, I have as well. The strangest place we've been was Mexico. Ensenada.
Ensenada, nice place. All right.
A challenge. Also Romania. We did a lot of work in Romania, in Galați.
Really?
I don't know if you know the shipyard in Galați.
No.
That's in the south of Romania. That's also very special.
Yeah.
The thing
Turkey?
Sorry?
A lot of boats are being built in Turkey.
No, we've never been to Turkey. No.
Okay. All right.
No, maybe after this next year.
Yeah, maybe.
Turkey not, and the east part of the world not yet, like China and all the south not yet, but maybe it comes.
Yeah.
To put things in, that's also always a challenge. We had some things that we had to be with a lot of people and a lot of narrow spaces to get things in. We do a lot is that we cut it in pieces. When it doesn't fit, also worktops or under counters or whatever, a fridge, we build our own fridges. So the custom built fridges.
Really?
Yeah. And then we build it in pieces, we bring it in, and then we weld and we polish it on site. And I have a very, very good welder. He also travels all over the world to do welds for other companies as well, for other factories. And then when he's finished, you don't see the weld. Nowhere. It's smooth, it's polished.
Yeah, I've seen these welds that are invisible. Yeah, I know they're possible. I wouldn't imagine how to do it. Because don't you have to like match the metal as well? Like the metal you're adding has to be the same kind of recipe as the top or whatever you're doing.
What you're adding it is to be one quality higher. So when the metal, when your top is quality 304, that's the quality of stainless steel. We do the adding of the wire with 316. That's a technical story. It doesn't make any sense.
Wow, the welding is not so cool.
The welding is not so difficult itself. The welding is just cooking water, boiling water. That's welding.
Okay.
You put two pieces of metal against each other, and you melt it, so you make your welds. That's okay. I can teach you in 2 hours, and you can do it the same. But the trick is the finishing.
Yes.
And that's the trick. You have to polish it, so you grind it. It has to be smooth. You don't want to make very big scratches on the side of your weld.
But you said you've added something in between that's one grade higher. Is that right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Okay.
That's what you do. You show you have your welding wire. Normally the welding, what we do is you see it as a glowing point. The point glows and that melts your metal to each other. And then you add your wire, so your 316 wire, and you make a little bit, you fill the gap with the wire.
Okay. So the metal is welded to itself. It doesn't need that extra stuff on top. That's the cosmetic. To seal it, okay.
No, to seal it, but also to make material. If there's a space in between the welds, then you have to make a material in between to fill it.
So okay.
That depends on all situations. Technical story. Then the finishing.
I like that stuff.
The finishing, that's the most important. When you are finished and you don't see any gaps or you don't see any, how do you see it? How do you call it? When you have like a flat top, it doesn't need to do like this.
Oh yeah, it's level.
That's very important. Also scratches when you are polishing it, you grind it with a sandpaper. That's what you do, like the simple way of telling it.
Mm-hmm.
When you scratch too deep, you get scratches on the left and the back of your weld, and it also looks terrible. So that are things.
Well, now that we've talked about stainless, I feel like. And I want your input on this for sure, because I feel like stainless steel galleys are kind of pointless, like countertops for sure. But I feel like vertical surfaces and the walls that aren't even going to get heated and the cabinets and everything stainless. I feel like that's just what people do when they can't think of anything better. I think some chefs ask for it when they don't have knowledge of other materials that might be available. Because I think stainless steel is a really impractical surface, except for the countertop, but for sure. But like, it scratches pretty easy. It always looks dirty. It dents. Like, it's, I don't understand. Like, I think it's become like a cliche. It's like, well, stainless galley, it will make it look professional. It's like, it looks like a morgue. And a lot of these really high end kitchens, you know, in the Michelin star kitchens outside of Yachting, they're not doing stainless steel anymore. It's not inspiring, it's not warm. It's not anything, really. It's an impractical service. But that's my pitch. What do you think?
Yeah, we see that a lot. For practical sides, so when you are on the hot side of the galley, along the range, we do almost stainless steel because that's going to be greasy. The back walls of a range. Sometimes we have a round back wall. We do with stainless steel or we have like with angles in it. But that's okay. You can easily clean it.
Yeah.
When you have all the cabinets like on the... we call it always the cold side, where you have like your dishwasher and you do some cutting. You can make like nice wooden cabinets, painted cabinets, whatever you want. You can make every design in it. What we do now with some galleys, we did now 2 or 3, we make like a lightning under the worktop. I think I have some pictures. And then your worktop is lightning over the cabinets, over the under cabinets. And then it looks also more friendly and more like a, like a Michelin star restaurant galley.
Yeah, I think it's going to change soon. Like, I think you're going to be able to tell a time frame of all the stainless steel galleys. Like, oh, that probably was done in this 2015, 2024, you know, in that area when everyone was doing stainless steel galleys. But I think you're right. I think yachting kind of follows in the footsteps of Michelin star. And they're doing some really cool kitchens that, you know, it's an inspiring place to work instead of this morgue, as I call it. But I think that's product knowledge too. I remember on Magumba, we had black marble or black granite countertops, and we had these black tiles. Now the tiles were horrible because they got slippery so quickly. But I love the parallel black surfaces. And then we had, I think it was cool, like kind of flecked gray, and then it turned into stainless on the refit. That was out of my control. But I love that the idea, like there's other materials out there. There's other color patterns to have. You can do cool shit. It's kind of limitless, especially when you talk about money. It's like stainless is not cheap either. No, like you can find other stuff.
So many people, so many wishes. Somebody likes like a white or yellow or black or purple, whatever you want. So that's
all. Yeah.
What we see more now is composite.
When
you use like a marble, a real marble, it cracks when it gets hot. It
sucks.
Get all kind of dirty flecks in it when you use sour things or onions or we do now more is composite, and it looks like a marble or a stone or whatever, and it's really good. It can exist the heat. You can make sinks under it. You can make tops over it, so you have like a complete worktop. That's something we do more and more, and that you can choose in every color if you like.
Yeah, it's like limitless. Yeah. It's really, it's your imagination, and it's, I love that. As much as stainless steel countertops are cool, like it doesn't really have to be. The thing that's hard for chefs down the line is any kind of seam in the countertop. So any kind of, and especially like you said before, you got to cut them and bring them in, and those seals do sometimes fail depending on what it's made of, and you got to bring a pressure washer and you'd be disgusted at what comes out of the cracks. Also, if you have like a raised lip on the countertop, that's also sometimes a seam, and that's also disgusting. But I think, I guess what I'm asking, like with a composite, I've also seen composite mixed improperly and crack and shatter in the first year. I'm not going to say which boat, but I just think outside the box, chefs. It doesn't have to be stainless. It doesn't, you know, like, I don't know.
Stainless is a standard, but it's not always the best.
I don't think it's the best. What's the best?
What you say when you have like a galley installer and they don't weld the tops, and you get all, when you have like a flat top and the top angled against it, and this is glued with the silicone. Oh, it's terrible.
And the silicone lasts maybe a year, and then that pulls up. And every time you put silicone back in there, it lasts like a month. Like if the original silicone lasts a while, but then everything that gets replaced after that, it just pops out.
But that has to do with maintenance. That's another thing we do. I think when you have like a galley where you put out like 15 hours a day meals.
With guests on, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I think yes. You have to do maintenance as well. When you drive in your car, you can also don't drive 150,000 kilometers, or on your motorbike, your BMW. It also needs some oil.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, for sure. And also the silicone gaps on the back of a countertop, you always have a silicone because it has to be, it has to be
watertight
against the wall.
Yeah.
So you have to change that every year. You cut it out, you clean it with a good cleaner, you make a good primer under it, and then you glue it again. Another thing what we see with maintenance, maybe I go one step further now, is that you get complaining from chefs, our induction top doesn't work so good anymore, it's not heating fast enough, or it's And then I said, do you do maintenance? Yeah, we clean the filters one time a year. Yeah, but there's a little bit more than maintenance. Or my combi steamer is leaking. It's always leaking. It's terrible. It's always leaking. When did you get the last maintenance? I don't know. The engineers look at it. But maybe we come over, do a good maintenance. And then you see which can be solved. And that's also with the silicon parts. When you have a worktop, which is glued together, you can't weld it anymore. When it's once glued, it's not possible to weld it anymore. But then you need to do like a maintenance sealant every year. And then you keep it quiet.
Okay, so this is controversial. So you mean I'm not supposed to wait till the stuff starts falling out? I'm supposed to just cut it out myself and redo it before it happens?
Okay. Every month is maybe a little bit too much, but
I like that idea. Yeah. Because it always just comes out again and again. How often do you recommend maintenance on ovens and cooktops? Because we do rely on engineering for help with that stuff. But I'm always happy, and so are the NGOs, just to schedule a service with whatever I got, Rational MKN, whatever ovens I got, like, come hook it up.
We advise once a year, and then when we come over, we take all out of part. So we get, like, for example, induction hubs. All people say induction hub doesn't need to do any maintenance. And then we take it out. We do a lot of MKN. We are specialists of MKN.
Yeah.
And MKN has under each zone in the glass plate, you have, for example, four zones in your glass plate. Mm. Under each zone is one generator, induction generator.
Yeah.
Inside that induction generator, my very Dutch English.
No, it's good, man. Killing it.
There are some semiconductors. That's a piece of, how do you call it? It's something it's in. And that can't resist heat. So that's very important to clean all the parts which are around the semiconductors. Another thing inside is a small ventilator. We every year change the ventilator from our customers. We do yearly maintenance. We change the ventilators, small fans which inside. And there's some maintenance. Yeah, there's for sure some maintenance. The ovens, for example, the combi steamers, either you have a Rational or an MKN or Electrolux, there are a lot of parts inside with water, the boiler or the water inlets. The MKNs have the siphon box with the pumps on the backside. All the engineers are watching, they know it. There's a gasket in between that starts to leak after 2 years. So we change it every year. And then so much of problems in your service when you are having guests on board or owners on board, which you can solve that you cannot cook. You cannot make your meals. So for sure, once a year is amazing. We have a lot of clients. We do once a year service.
That's I think we do every yard. Like if there's a yard, I'll just get someone to service, especially the Rationales, because that's just like, we happen to have Rationales on board, but I always like to do it before summer season too, because you don't want it to shit out in the middle of the summer. Winter you can kind of handle, but then it's like harder to get, people there to take a look at it. Let's see. What other advice is it hard to work with a chef like for that's doing the first refit? Are they kind of open, or because you could get a chef far along enough in their career where they would do it quite well, I reckon, and then you get a chef that's in their first year or second year getting it and they don't have a clue.
No, but most of the time you have rotating chefs, so you have two chefs, and then one is a little bit more experienced than the other one. And a lot of chefs, while you're talking with, they, you get there. How do you say it? They know you. You talk from the practical side, and then they listen, and they also can tell their story, what they want, because every chef on the yard has experience. You're not coming on the yard without any experience. Wow. So they have restaurant experience, banqueting experience, hotel experience, whatever. So not like dumb people. And that you can put into your plans and work them out. And if they come over and they say, I want to have, things, but doesn't work.
Okay. Yeah, melee professional. Those things are pieces of shit.
Melee is great for washing machines, but for laundry, but I don't think for dishwashers.
You're right. For laundry, I think the ones we have on board are, I know they're melee, but I don't think there's any complaints, but they'd have this way of putting the word professional on like a real bad dishwasher. And then expects it to be like, act like a Hobart. And everyone sees that word professional and they think they're safe. They think they bought the right. It's like, oh, it's going to be professional. Great. And I think leaks, domestic. Yeah, exactly. Stainless steel. It's got to be stainless steel.
And also the speed of a dishwasher. When you have like a Hobart, we always sell.
Oh, it's best. Yeah.
I think in 1 minute, 2 minutes or 3 minutes, your dish complete, clean, dry, good.
You can easily change the setting on how long you want it, and then you can. It doesn't really clean itself, but it kind of does. You do have to open it and pull stuff out, but of course, it's not a magic box. You know, it needs some maintenance. What there's something funny I wanted to ask you. Can't remember now though. Oh yeah, you hinted at it earlier. How do you feel about salamanders? Like, is that the most common thing that comes out in a refit?
Yeah.
Yards put them in and chefs take them out.
We have a lot in the scrapyard.
I knew it. So I did a poll on board, on one of the big chef sites, like rotational superyacht chefs. Like, how many chefs use salamanders? And I gave an option. And it came out to about 50% do. You know, 50%, and some of them are grumbling, like, oh, chefs today don't know how to use them. I'm like, put your common steamer on 300 and take the water down, and you have something way better, way more even than a fucking salamander. And you could do more than one. You could just, of course. And so that, like, I was like, 50%, that's shocking. I didn't think it was that high. But think about like 50% of people saying no to hobs or no to a fryer or no to a grill. It's like, no, you're always going to use, every chef 100% is going to use those things. 50% means get out. Like, you're not welcome.
Also with hops, when you talk about hops, then I see a lot of posts on Facebook groups and things like that. And then they talk about hops. Oh, you have to buy a Miele or a Gaggenau. Or then I think a Gaggenau hop in an environment where you have to make a lot of meals for a lot of guests, a lot of people. Try something professional. And if that's MKN, I prefer MKN, but if it is MKN or EGO or Burner or Roland or whatever, but then Gaggenau or Miele, I think, Miele, you're using your domestic kitchen, but not in a professional environment.
And that's something you can't tell on any of the platforms, is like the chef's history, his or her history could be, they only know Gaggenau, you know, they're from a 20, 30 meter boat and first they started with some crazy Italian brand, and then they got Gaggenau and they were impressed with it. But then, like, man, no good restaurants use that. But that reminded me of another question, because I think it was Gaggenau or somebody else that was doing a lot of like non-zone specific induction hobs. Have you seen those very much, or is there any new technology in induction? Because I
don't understand.
Like, say there was, like, this is the square of the hob.
Yeah.
There would be like, no matter what size like pot you put on it, the induction would only come to that pot, that size. So you didn't have, if you had a small pot, you didn't have to put it directly in the middle. You could just have like kind of anywhere you wanted.
It's not something special for Gaggenau. All the brands have it. When you have like a normal, smaller induction coil, for example, a 3.5 kilowatt coil, then you have like the point induction. When you have, I don't have an example here, when this is, but this is your induction, your coil. Yeah. So this is the complete copper coil. Then only in the middle, when you put the pot on the middle, then you have induction. Induction is not heat. Induction is a coil with a magnetic field. And the top, what you put on the coil, it heats. So the magnetic field goes through the pot, to the pan, and that heats. When you have what you say is, we call it a flatbed induction. You have two coils, two smaller coils under one zone. And on that small coil, you can put, like, if it fits, the minimum size of the pot is 12 centimeters, 120 millimeters. But if it fits, you can put like three on a coil, two or three or whatever, or you put them on this side of the coil or this side. But that's something from induction almost every brand has.
but it's relatively new because I only found out about it when I was doing the Magumbo refit, like which would have been like maybe 2017, 2018. But it seemed pretty smart where you could just have more stuff on your hob, like especially for guest trips when you have just lots of little things. You don't have one big thing. It's
a lot of chefs when they work in a restaurant, especially like a Michelin star restaurant or a bigger a good restaurant, they have like the French hot plate, you know, the big.
Oh yeah. Plate.
They put all the small pans or pots of sauce on it and the small things on it. And that you can do with a flatbed induction as well. Very good. What we also can do when we're building the range ourselves, which we also sometimes do, so no MKN, but our own brand with a Swiss branded induction inside, the technical part from another brand. Then we can also make two controllers for one zone. So you have four zones on a plate.
Oh, wow. You really have eight.
Controllers on the one zone. And then there's eight controllers for one plate.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
That does sound cool. Yeah. Well, and so something I've noticed is a lot more touchscreen stuff happening with induction hobs. How have chefs, I know my opinion, but how do chefs react to that, where there's like some sort of plus or minus button either on the hob or down underneath it? What are your thoughts?
There's one brand who uses it, which works quite good. The other brands who does it is like the Miele or the Gaggenau things, so the semi-professional things. That works okay. What I prefer is like a knob.
You need
to have a feeling of a gas range. That's stupid in a galley from a yacht, but the feeling of a chef when you turn it a little bit higher, a little bit lower, you know what I mean. And then when you have to push a display, you don't get a feeling of a little bit more or a little bit less.
No, I agree with you. And sometimes with wet hands or you can't touch it, you know. I agree with you. I want a knob, but I also want a graduated one. So I don't have to look. I just go, I need it on three. And I feel three and I walk away. So when I get smooth ones, like, I don't know. I'll see what we get, like on this little baby refit we're doing on Arians. But the graduated knobs, like, I think we've gone too far with touchscreen. Like, everything was touchscreen. Yes, okay. It's new technology. Yeah. But sometimes just like something tactile, just analog, old school, like three notches, that sauce is going to be fine. I'm busy. I can walk away now rather than like, bending down, like
it's also with the combi steamers. All the chefs want the combi steamers, the rationals, or the MKNs. We do MKN with all the touchscreens and all the programs and all the things inside. And then I said, what are you going to do with it? I'm going to use it on a combi steam, 160 degrees, 20%
clustering.
Okay, are you going to do banqueting? Maybe, but regeneration of no, we don't do regeneration, everything is fresh. So, okay, you make something fresh. You put it on 200 degrees for 2 minutes in the combi steamer to peep it up, and then you give it away. Yeah, okay. Why do you want to have a combi steamer with all the other programs? That is very nice for a gas station or like a shop where people are. They need to put in a program. One, two, yes. Not for a chef.
I first time I got rationale. So I've actually never been on a boat with MKN, so I can't speak to them. I know they're comparable, if not the same or better than that rationale. They're awesome. They're known, their reputation is incredible. So when I first got a rationale, I was kind of doing the same shit. I'm like, put it on 160, but I'm American, so we cook at 350 Fahrenheit, which is closer to 180. So I was doing like 180, and I'm like, kind of didn't understand, keep the water in the cabinet, take it out of the cabinet, these programs, like what if, I don't know. So I just used it as I used it, and especially it's like, that galley got finished at 11 p.m. and we had guests on the next day. I was like, bye, no. and I think a little bit, this is, and I can only speak to rationale, it's a little bit their fault. Like, they don't have shit for instructional videos. Like, there's nothing. There's this one random dude in the States called Billy Buck. You can't make that shit up. And the videos work, all right? They're straightforward. He says, go ahead, way too much. Go ahead and do this. Go ahead and do that. Go ahead. Just tell me. I'll do it. But once you see these videos, it changes the way you cook. To have control over the moisture in the cabinet is incredible. To have a fan that powerful, incredible. To have a probe with I think five or seven data points on it, It's bullshit. It's so interesting. And I dove right in. If Rationale MK needs me to do some videos, I'll do some videos. Like, easy. It'd be fun. Like, people need the videos. Otherwise, certain chefs aren't going to, they're not going to learn anything. They're not going to care.
What we have at MKN, we have like the kind of chef line. The restaurant has it as well, so you can call a chef.
Yeah, that's big. Yeah.
Man, they're really good. They yeah. know what they're talking about. And we also sometimes put people on board and we say, okay, you go to South of Europe and help the chefs 1 day or 2 days, and they learn everything about the oven, about the all the whatever you want.
Well, the programs, yeah, but it's
all the limitless. Of the oven.
But yeah.
You don't use it so much. So, yeah.
But I think YouTube, man, YouTube, that's where everyone goes to learn. Yeah.
Google knows everything.
And besides, and also, like, yeah, YouTube does it right. That'd be like a superpower if you knew everything that was on YouTube. You'd also be an idiot at the same time. I don't know, which is it's crazy. But you, I think if you did YouTube videos, it'd be much more clear. Like, it really helped me, but it was really hard to find.
Yeah.
And I don't do the programs. You know, I do like cool shit, like overnight roasting, because it holds it. And I put a big cut in the night before and just show up in the morning and there's a protein done perfectly to held. And then there's like delta T on Rationale where you can, I think minimum is 20 degrees. So the meat's at room temp. So let's call it 20 degrees. That means the cabinet will only do 20 degrees above the meat. So that means the cabinet's 40. Then once the meat goes up to 30, then the cabinet's 50. And it's just like, it's the slowest way you're like warming things up to temperature. It's like these concepts are a little bit big and a little bit foreign if you're just used to having like two ovens in the kitchen, a normal one and a hot one in a fast kitchen, and that's it. And that's all you've ever needed. But now it just improves everything. It just makes it so much better. But I think there's a lack of resources online because a lot of chefs don't have time to like call someone, have them show up. Like,
that way you're rushed, for example. No, you need to find it and watch your tablet and then, okay, tick, 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 tick.
Yeah,
correct.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So get MK in to get me in there. I'll do some videos, man.
You want to see them?
Yeah, let's see. Let's see.
I take you around. Oh. Here are the biggest ones, but they're not for in the yard. This one we sell a lot in the yard. You see it?
Which one with the blue light? With the touchscreen in the middle.
Yeah. It's a six layer 1-1 GN.
Yes, a 6.1. That would be a Rationale.
Yeah. But this is the only one which has also a real 1-1 GN tray inside. A lot of the small combi steamers, they only have 2/3 of a GN.
Oh, that's bullshit. Yeah. No, you can't have 2/3 because that messes up every pan in the kitchen, the galley. 1-1,
and those are also for sale. This is with a hood on it. We don't do that in the yacht, but they also are for sale. I don't know if I have them here.
How come you don't do it on the yacht?
With a hood?
Yeah.
Because of the space. When you see this hood.
Oh geez, yeah.
This is way too big. Way too big for a yacht. So what we do a lot is we make a built-in machine. It looks a little bit like this. I'm sure you move around here. On the top of this, not from this machine, because this is a stacking kit, but when we have a built-in machine, we have on top the air intake and the air outlet. So you can easily build this in a like under in the cabinet, under a worktop, or if you have a double one, we make a rack with it, with two above each other. And then...
What model is that? Because I think my friend Ben, he's like loves that one.
This one.
What's it called? The XS? No. What's?
No. This is the compact. The MKN.
Compact. Yeah, that's the one. He loves it.
Space Combi Compact.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those are really great. Really great. And they have like a full the full power of a normal combi steamer. When you have like a Rationale, a big Rationale, it has a complete power. So you can put six layers in. You have a normal power. If you have like a smaller steamer, domestic one. You have maybe 70% or 60% of the power of a normal combi steamer.
Yeah.
So with this one, six layers, 1-1 GN, and the full power.
So that one you could suggest to people with nice homes as well. Like, because I've known people with money, and you go see their kitchen, you're like, who told you to buy this shit? Like, what? You have so much fun. You could have bought really nice, like, functional things, but I think people don't want to know.
No, maybe not. Maybe not.
And that one has a probe and everything in there?
Yeah, it's probe inside. I'll show you in here. Oh, the other one, the light birds, maybe more easy to see.
The probe is a game changer. It's so much better.
Yeah. See, this is a probe inside.
Yeah.
You can choose it in your program. If you go to cooking for a sample, you see this?
Yep.
Like a combi.
Okay, now I can see it. There we go.
Yeah. And here you can choose your time if you want, or you can choose the probe, and then you can choose the meat, the inside temperature of the meat, like 60 degrees. And then it chooses the temperature. And that's for this brand, but it's the same for all other brands as well.
And like, I think maybe this has changed too. Like the Rationals have a boiler.
Yeah.
For the water, for steam. Yeah. But MKN sprays on the element water. Yeah. Okay. Right. Which is like good, because like if there's no boiler, it's smaller, there's less space, so it fits better. But then if there's a boiler, then it's more consistent, right?
Yeah, a boiler, you have more consistent steam, and you also have steam at 100 degrees with a spray machine which sprays over the element. This one measures this, and it does with a flow meter. So it's not like it sprays some water in. It goes really with a measurement. And the only thing is you need to have the oven on a temperature like 90 degrees or 100 degrees, and then you're going to spray in, because otherwise you don't get steam. So with a boiler, you have more maintenance because a boiler gets scaled and it gets problems with overflowing of water. So for everything is something to say.
So this is what I know I can do in a restaurant. I assume I can do an MKN too, but you can sous vide cooking inside the ovens, but you can get, and I don't know how this works, man. It doesn't make any sense. You can get a cabinet down to the lowest 30 degrees. It's not as accurate as such low temperatures, but with full steam. So you can let's use chicken. It's higher. Let's go. I'm going to cook chicken breast to like 62.5, right? And it's pretty accurate. How that's below 100, I still don't understand. I just know it works. So instead of water baths, time for time, like I can just put it in the Rationale or the MKN and sous vide it in there and do way more and not have to worry about this little dumb pot of water sloshing around because we're underway.
Yeah.
I think that's going to be the future too. I think water baths go away a little bit because some of these combis, they're going to be super accurate, even more and more in the future.
No, I think as well. And what you say, less maintenance with no boiler, more accurate, more precise. So yeah, that's for sure.
There's trade-offs. Yeah.
Yeah. What we do with combi steamers as well, maybe I can show you as well. But we see a lot when we go on yachts for service. This is an example. This is two above each other.
Okay.
This is one machine, so that's not a complete good story to tell, but we see a lot of two combi steamers above each other, two separate machines. What we do when we make a set like this, I do it like a little bit like this.
I gotta move my stuff around too, because I gotta plug in. I'm gonna run out of battery. Keep talking.
What we do a lot is that we make a rack with sliders in. We put the combi steamers on the slider, on the roller, and you can easily roll it to the front when you have like a maintenance or a service or things like that. And it's very easy access to the back of the steamer, because always when you have a problem, it's on the back of the steamer.
Yeah. I've seen boats where there's no rollers, and it's like, that's a rookie error. That's a rookie error, because even at a certain point, even the engineer should be like, no. We need rollers. They have to come out.
Terrible. It's really terrible. Yeah, we make them always. We try to have to put everything on rollers because of the service and because of the maintenance. It's more easy. You lost your cable.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to spin this around. Yeah, a little backstory for everyone. My computer shat its bed today. So this is the first time I'm doing, I'm shooting it on the phone. And I'm at like 1% battery. So let's get this over here and we can continue. All right, another view of my, we can turn that down. My wonderful hotel room here in Gothenburg.
Oh, good.
All right, we're in, we got power. Yeah, man.
Yeah, that's something to keep in mind as well. When you do a refit or you do a change of, you buy new ovens, then also try to make it easy for the engineers when you are in a rush, because when a failure is always in a rush, and no, never on Monday morning at 11 after coffee.
No, the opposite. Think of the worst time possible. That's when it's going to shit the bed. Have you ever put rollers on dish machines, or are they just so light you just pull them out?
Oh, they're so light you can easily slide them out.
Yeah, okay.
What we do with dishwashers is that we put them in a tray. So the back of the tray is banded 20 millimeters. The side of the tray is banded 20 millimeters. So it's completely closed. And when something is leaks, it goes to the front and you see quite easy that it's leaking.
Yeah.
When you slide it in a cabinet without any tray, then it starts to leak and it goes on the back of the cabinet and on the floor.
Yeah.
The floor is
into a guest cabin. And what kind of mistakes have been made with where to put the generators for the induction? You know, like, I know as we have them now, they're right under the hobs, but I've also seen galleys where they're just somewhere else. They're accessible, but they're like tucked away.
The generators, then again, MKN has one generator under each zone. So it is inside the, behind the front when you have your induction. I can show you here. I have an induction over here. Do you see it?
Yeah.
This is with a wok. I don't know the English name, but.
Yeah, wok.
Yeah, okay. We have an induction over here. And behind this panel, this is your front panel. When we have a cooking range, what we build, we always build a range out of one piece. So it looks a little bit different. But behind this, behind this panel, there's the generator. That's the induction, the power supply for the induction.
Yeah.
So that's from this brand. This is the only brand who has it like, almost the only brand who has it like this.
Built in.
Yeah, built in. But also can, put your back on my table, is that you choose a spot to put like two generators for four coils, or one generator for two coils or whatever. And it has to be a spot with good ventilation and good cooling. Inside, there are a lot of electrical components. And there are the semiconductors, what I told before. They need to have cooling. The thing of a semiconductor, one part inside the generator, is when it heats up, the power gets low. So it always has to be cooled, good cooled, to keep the power inside that piece of equipment.
Okay.
They see a lot. Then they design a galley, and then... we need to have a spot for the generator.
Yeah, exactly. I've done that. I've done that where you're just like, oh, brother, we're going to cut this cabinet in half and fit the generator in there. I'm like, oh, no.
Airspace. There we have a gap.
Yeah.
So we always try to put them or in an engine room or in a cabinet, which is a little bit cooled or good ventilated. And then you don't have any problems. But
that's a good tip. They don't even need to be in the galley. Just find some other spot.
25 meters from your range, you can put them if you want.
Okay.
The same with cooling machines, where you see a lot of galleys with fridges and freezers with the compressor built in. So you have all standalone units.
Yeah, it's noisy.
That's noisy and heaty. It gets very hot. It's sucking all the air out of the galley. It's a lot of greasy and fat air. So your condensers, but on top of it, they get greasy, they heat up, they don't cool anymore. So we always try to fit the compressors into the engine room or another room where they have space. And that's the same with your induction generators. Try to put them in the same place as the your cooling machines, or a place where it is cool, where your fan coils are, or something like that.
We've also had on Magumba, we had our fan, our galley extraction fan was next to the galley. It wasn't even above it. You know, it was under these stairs. Like, it was a perfect spot because this spot was good for nothing except an extraction fan.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's another thing like maybe chefs don't think of, like a lot of these things that you don't actually want in the galley. Like, you're just going to take a valuable space. And if you can kind of like acquire some space from another department and figure out like, hey, do you mind if we have this space now and stick a big fan in it? It's a good move. It builds space and less is noise too. To have extraction out away from the gallery, I think it quite common is. It's not like always. It's quieter. It's much nicer.
A lot of yachts where we are, the extraction fan is on top of the top deck, above the top deck, so you don't have any space. And the controllers are in the galley, so that's all fine. We also rebuilt some fridges with the compressor down in the engine room, if it's possible to put it in the engine room or to come with the cooling lines into the engine room.
Yeah,
that's also a thing we do.
That's a good idea, man. It's a good idea. But yeah, I think we covered all the bases. Is there anything you want to talk about? Oh, we didn't talk about motorcycles.
No.
We didn't talk about motorcycles at all. And then we got a little bit, yeah. So Dirk contacted me because he knows of my motorcycle habit. And he rebuilt a bike that I never thought would be an off-road beast. And he turned this like normal, like kind of like, I don't know, my first motorcycle thing into this horrible monster. It's so cool, man. I wish it was either, we could either have the MKNs in the background or his motorcycle in the background. But it's like, yeah, they're still both is interesting. I've seen his before, during, and after, like cutting the frame, making it perfect. And it looks like, I thought it was an HP2. That's what it looks like. Yeah.
That's also a nice story. My hobby is I drive motorcycle like you do. Love to drive off-road, which you do as well.
You do dual sport, though. You do much more invasive.
It looks a little bit like rally. You have on the television the Dakar rally. We do like a two times a year, we do like a sort of game, which looks a little bit like a Dakar rally, but not in the desert, but more in the like in Spain, in Italy, in the eastern part of Europe. That's with big bikes, over 200 kilo, off-road, and then serious off-road.
Wow.
That's a big hobby of me. I love the HP2, the BMW HP2. For people who know the BMW, the HP2 is like a little bit of a cult off-road bike.
Yeah.
And I had one as well, and I sold it. Yeah. I had a really nice one, but it was some guy who wants to have it more than I did, so... And then a friend of mine, before the HP2 came out, it was in 2005, he wanted to buy a Gaston Rayet rally replica. Gaston Rayet was a famous Dakar driver. He won the Dakar in, I don't know, 92 or whatever with the BMW. But it was not for sale. So he designed his own frame with a famous frame builder in Holland, Bakker frame. And he designed a complete motorbike from a road bike, the L50R. It's like an old man bike for on the road, into a dual sport bike, a real one. So yeah, I had all the paperwork from him, and he helped me with tips and tricks, and you have to do it like this and a little bit like that. And I built my own rally bike, and I did the Gibraltar race. It's a rally last year with the bike. It was amazing. It flies over the stones, and I love it, really love it.
That's awesome, man. That's when you said, maybe I misheard you, when you said someone wanted your HP2 more than you, they stole it or they bought it from you?
No, they bought it from me.
Okay, good. All right, good. That'd be a sad story if that's what we say in the States sometimes when someone steals your shit. Like, someone else wanted it more than I did.
No. But it's, they're not so much built, I think, like 5,000 or something.
Yeah, just the 1 year, right? Like 2004?
To 2005 to 2007, I believe. Or 2006?
Earlier, yeah, because I think 06 they changed the to the 1200. Because the HP, is the HP2 1200 or is it 1150? Okay, so yeah, you're right. Then it's 05, 06 for sure.
Yeah, 05, 06, I believe, yeah. So there are like, I believe, 2,000 in the world. And when there's one for sale, they ask like craziest prices for it, more than it's ever costed new.
Really?
Yeah, it's amazing. So yeah, I sold it.
Made some money. That's a good, it's a happy story.
For that, I built the L50 Rally. That's the RL50 Rally. So
What kind of horsepower does that have? Like comparable? Is it? It's probably lighter because HP2s are quite heavy, weren't they?
Yeah, HP2 is 220, I believe.
210,
220, and this is also approximately 210 kilos.
Okay.
So you buy like a normal BMW with GS, it's 240 kilos.
Yeah.
So to do some off-road driving with a bike like that, you need to have it light. Light is right.
Yeah, it helps.
Yeah. So that's it's like, I think 210 kilos with all the liquids in, 210. And it has 86 or 89 horsepower, something like that.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Very low rev. So when you go in the low rev, it does everything you want.
Yeah, that's like on my bike, I've got about 85 bhp out of the box. I don't know what it is now, but so without going too much into it, the engine had to be rebuilt, and I found so much carbon on that on top of one cylinder head. Or I didn't find it. It was just obvious. It's like, holy shit. So hopefully I'll get some more horsepower back. But what I want to ask you is, like, I wonder if it's a similar gearbox to mine. Because first gear on my bike is fast. Like, there's no crawling gear. Because sometimes you just want to crawl. So you're always, like, feathering the clutch to go up hills. And then you're doing wheelies and shit. And you don't want to do wheelies. And like, but is that the same on your bike? Is it kind of a fast first gear?
1200 or
no, 1150. 1150. Yeah, the Bumblebee.
The Bumblebee. It's the same gear. Yeah. Same gear.
That's what you have.
Yeah,
that first gear, but I love the gearbox. The gearbox is pretty sweet. It kind of works and everything. It's just that's the only thing I'm like, man, I wish I had like a slow first gear.
Oh, but when you go downhill, I do also a lot of, when I go, you need to go uphill, and then you go downhill into the rocks. You put it in the first gear, and then it goes on your own gear. You don't have to brake or whatever. I really love it.
Yeah, no, I love it too. That's my only complaint, though, because I've been like with my girlfriend at the time on the back plus camping gear. So two people stuff plus camping gear going up this famous mountain pass in the Rocky Mountains called Engineer's Pass. And there's switchbacks, of course, like all muddy and just like I'm turning and like I'm doing kind of wheelies up the over the switchback on the turning point because I got to slow down and give it power. And it's like, oh, God. But there's so much weight on the back with the two of us plus camping gear that it was so light in the front.
It's light in the front. I put 21-inch front wheel in, so you get
a little... Huge. That's huge. That's so much better. 17. I got a 19 on the front. It sucks, man. Because once you get a 21, you're like, it just rolls right over everything. It's so easy. But a 19, you've got to hit it first and then get it up over it. So hard, man.
I did a Gibraltar race with a BMW GS rally with original wheels in. It's also with a 19-inch. And then we did from Romania, from Brasov to Gibraltar. So all the Balkan and then to France, Spain, Portugal, back to Spain, to the center of Spain, and then down to Gibraltar. It was 9,000 kilometers. But I did with a normal GS. They call it a rally, but it's only the color, only the rally color, nothing else.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
Yeah. With a 19-inch front wheel into the mountains, into the rocks, it was really, really hard work.
Yeah, it's work. It's more work. A 21 makes it easier. Just
19-inch, it goes like this, and then when you go into the sand, it's terrible.
Yeah. Well, Derek, we probably poured the shit out of all the chefs that don't ride motorcycles, so we should probably call it.
Look away now.
Yeah. We should have said like brakes, skidding. Like that's the end of all cooking, and now motorcycle. But yeah, we'll talk more. We'll say goodbye, but hang out after, and then I have a couple more questions for you. But thanks for coming on, man. It's been I think it's going to be helpful for chefs. Thanks for helping the community.
I hope if they have any questions, ask you, and then you ask me, and then we're open for helping. always.
Yeah, man. Thanks a lot for coming on board. You're a great guy, and thanks for this episode of I Get the Fork Out.